that he acquires a portion of it. Now you can see why an employee with a positive mind is worth more than one with a negative mind. The employee who thinks in terms of enthusiasm naturally is one who is happy in his work. He therefore radiates a wholesome mental attitude that spreads to those around him, and they too take on a part of his attitude. Accordingly, they become more efficient workers. But that is not the only reason why the person who expresses enthusiasm as a habit promotes himself into the more desirable positions of life. Enthusiasm, as I have already stated, gives one a keener imagination, increases his initiative, makes him more alert of mind, gives him a more pleasing personality, and thereby attracts the cooperation of others. These traits of mind make it inevitable that one promotes himself into any position which he may become capable of filling. Every thought one releases becomes a definite part of one's character. This transformation takes place through the principle of autosuggestion. One does not have to be a mathematician to figure out what will happen to the person whose dominating thoughts are positive, in view of the fact that such a person is adding power to his own character with every thought he releases. Thought by thought, he builds a personality that provides him with a strong will, a keen imagination, self-reliance, persistence, initiative, and the courage and ambition to desire and to acquire whatever he wants. An employer has but little to do with the promotion of such a person. If one employer neglects to recognize his ability, he finds another who will, but he manages to keep growing and advancing in any direction he chooses.
I get the idea, Mr. Carnegie. An employee whose mind is dominated by the spirit of enthusiasm is beneficial to an employer not only by his influence on other employees, but because of his own acquired strength of personality. Is that what you mean?
That's what I mean. And the principle applies to everyone, not merely to an employee. Take the owner of a retail store, for example, and you will find that his mental attitude is definitely reflected in every person who works in the store. I have heard it said that a skilled psychologist can walk through any retail store, study the employees a few minutes, and then give a surprisingly accurate description of the owner or the dominating head of the store without ever seeing him or hearing a word spoken by him.
Then one might say that a store or a business has its own personality, consisting of the dominating influence of the personnel of the business. Is that true?
Yes, and it is true of the home or any place where people gather regularly. The psychologist with a keen sense of perception can walk into any home, get the mental feel of the place, and tell precisely whether the home is dominated by the spirit of harmony or the spirit of bickering and friction. The mental attitude of people leaves its permanent influence on the very atmosphere of their environment. Every city, for example, has its own rate of vibration, made up of the dominating influences and the mental attitudes of the people who live there. Moreover, every street and every block in every street has its own personality, each being so different from the others that the trained psychologist can walk down any street blindfolded and pick up enough information from the mental feel of the street to give an accurate description of the people who live there.
That seems almost incredible, Mr. Carnegie.
Perhaps it may to the inexperienced person, but not so to the skilled interpreter of people's mental attitude. If you wish convincing evidence of the accuracy of what I have said, make an experiment of your own. Take a walk down Fifth Avenue in New York City and observe the feeling of opulence you pick up as you go along. Then go across to the tenement section, take a stroll down that thoroughfare, and observe the feeling of defeatism and poverty that you will pick up. The experiment will provide you with undeniable evidence that the vibrations of Fifth Avenue and the vibrations of the Tenement Street are direct opposites, one negative, the other positive. Carry the experiment still further by going into private homes. Choose a home where you know there is domestic harmony and cooperation. Study carefully the mental feel you pick up in this home without anyone speaking a word to you. Then go into a home where you know the domestic relationship is disturbed by inharmony and family friction. Study the mental feel you pick up there. By the time you have made a dozen such experiments, you will know from firsthand experience that every home has a mental atmosphere that harmonizes perfectly with the mental attitude of those who live there. This experiment will also convince you that there is some unknown law of nature which fixes the habits of thought and tends to give them permanency. The law not only gives permanency to thought in the mind of the individual, but it extends the influence of that thought to the environment in which one lives.
It will pay anyone to stand on the sidelines of life and watch himself go by so he may see himself as others see him. Control Your Attention, Chapter 12.
Mr. Carnegie, you have named the 12th principle of the philosophy of individual achievement, controlled attention. Will you describe how this principle can be applied in the practical affairs of life?
Very well. Let us take note, first of all, of the fact that controlled attention is directly related to all the previous 11 principles we have analyzed. As a matter of fact, there is a portion of each of these 11 principles combined with the principle of controlled attention. From this, you will observe that the proper approach to mastery of the principle of controlled attention is by mastery and application of the 11 principles previously covered. Now let us define the term controlled attention and make sure we understand exactly what it means. It is the act of combining all the faculties of the mind and concentrating them upon the attainment of a definite purpose. The time involved in the act of concentration of thought on a given subject depends upon the nature of the subject and upon that which one expects in connection with it. Take my own case, for example. The dominating forces of my mind are, and have been for many years, concentrated upon the making and marketing of steel. I have others allied with me who likewise concentrate their dominating thoughts upon the same objective. Thus we have the benefit of controlled attention in collective form, consisting as it does of the individual mind power of a great number of people, all working toward the same end in a spirit of harmony.
Could you not have carried on other business activities just as successfully as you conducted the steel industry, and at the same time? Wouldn't the mastermind principle have made this possible?
I have known men to conduct many separate, unrelated businesses successfully with the aid of the mastermind, but I have always believed they would have done much better had they confined their efforts entirely to one line of business. Splitting one's attention has the effect of dividing one's powers. The best plan for anyone to follow is to devote all his energies to some specific field. This concentration enables one to specialize in that field.
But what about doctors who engage in general practice? Do they not have a better opportunity to add to their income than those who specialize in one particular branch of medicine?
The exact opposite is true. If you ever have occasion to engage a specialist to remove your appendix, as I have had, you will learn that specialization in medicine pays. When I was a small boy, the old family physician who used to look after the health of the people of our neighborhood would have removed an appendix for $25, and I suspect he could have done the job about as well as the specialist who charged me more than 10 times that amount. But I called in the specialist just the same.
Does this same rule apply in the field of retail merchandising?
It applies in every line of business and every calling. Modern merchandising has practically made the old-fashioned general store obsolete. While the most prosperous stores are departmentalized, they are not the same as the old general merchandise stores, because each department is managed by a specialist who devotes all his time to that department. You might say that a modern department store is nothing but a group of highly specialized stores, all operating under one roof and one general overhead, but possessing increased buying power that gives the store a tremendous advantage over smaller stores.
You would say, then, that the department store is managed under the principle of controlled attention?
That and other principles of the philosophy of individual achievement, especially the mastermind principle and definiteness of purpose.
What about the banking business? Is it managed also by application of the principle of controlled attention?
Very much so. Every department of a large bank, and practically every individual position in each department, is highly specialized. The same is true of railroading. Practically every position in the railroad business is specialized. Promotions are from the bottom upward, and the men holding the more responsible positions have had training in nearly all the subordinate positions, but they never undertake to hold two jobs at the same time. It is the same in the steel industry. Men become highly skilled by confining their efforts to specialized work. Here, too, promotions are from the bottom upward. All of our head men have served their apprenticeship in subordinate jobs in the operating end of the business.
You believe, then, that the better opportunities of the future will be available to those who concentrate their efforts along some specialized lines?
It has always been that way. Perhaps it always will be.
What about the profession of teaching? Is it not possible for a teacher to prepare himself to teach many different subjects?
It is possible, but not advisable. The big universities are nothing but a group of associated colleges, each specializing in some particular branch of education. If it were practical for a teacher to do better work by devoting his efforts to a diversity of subjects, the universities would have discovered this long ago.
What about the student who is preparing himself for a life work? Should he specialize in some particular branch of education?
Yes, if he knows what his definite major purpose in life is to be. Otherwise, he should confine his efforts to a general education course until such time as he chooses a goal. Then he should continue his education through specialized training. The lawyer, for example, usually takes a course in general education, then specializes in law. The doctor usually does likewise. General education gives one an approach to organized thinking, self-discipline, and self-reliance, all the essential qualities for success in any calling.
What about the stenographer? Should he or she concentrate on one line of work?
The stenographer must specialize, obviously, before procuring a position. After that, he may have to engage in general service for a time, but the stenographer who does not wish to remain in that sort of work takes stock of his opportunities while engaged in general office work, and sooner or later specializes in some particular department through which he can promote himself to a better position. Many of the more successful business and industrial leaders of our time got their start through stenographic positions, where they had an opportunity to study the methods of their superiors. This is among the finest of all types of office work as far as preparation for executive responsibilities is concerned. The stenographer literally goes to school to highly skilled executives and is paid for doing so.
What about the farmer? Should he specialize also?
Yes, he should, but usually he does not. This is one of the major weaknesses of agriculture. The men who are making the most money from the soil are those who specialize in certain crops, such as wheat, rye, barley, and trucking. The farmer who raises a little of everything very seldom receives much for anything he raises.
What about the bookkeeper? Should he specialize too?
Yes, unless he is contented to remain always a bookkeeper. And even then, he will make more from his work if he specializes in some particular branch of accounting. The better-paid men in this field usually branch out from general bookkeeping to auditing and the installation of accounting systems. A clever man in this field finds it quite profitable, for every business beyond the one man's size needs dependable records of its transactions.
Now, I am going to give you a hard one, Mr. Carnegie. What about the young woman who intends to marry? What chance has she of specializing, unless it is in connection with pots and pans and the rearing of babies?
That's not as hard as you imagine. Of all the people who should specialize for a life work, I can think of no one who might do so to better advantage than the woman who intends to make marriage a career. Sure, she should specialize. She should specialize first in the psychology of managing a husband, by learning how to inspire a man to do his very best. After that, she should specialize in household economy, so she may contribute her part in managing the home. She should specialize also in dietetics, so she will know how to feed a family the sort of food that aids in the maintenance of sound health.
But, Mr. Carnegie, this looks like a lot of specializing. Wouldn't that make a housewife a sort of maid of all work?
It need not. It all comes under the heading of preparation for the career of marriage, the greatest of all careers. The woman who completes a college course can plan her education so she will learn how to manage a home, and if she intends to marry, that is precisely what she should do. If she wishes to become a career woman, of course she should plan her education accordingly.
So there seems to be no way out of the responsibility of concentrating one's efforts if one is to succeed?
No, the jack of all trades usually is good at none. There is some part that everyone can take in the scheme of affairs, some part through which he can render useful service and gain his just compensation. It is everyone's responsibility to find out what his part is and to prepare himself for it. A well-ordered life requires preparation. Before one begins to prepare, he should know for what he is preparing himself. That within itself is concentration of effort. The man who has no definite purpose in life, who cannot do some one thing and do it well, is like a dry leaf on the bosom of the wind. He will be tossed here and there, wherever the winds of chance carry him. But, like the rolling stone, he will gather no moss. Unfortunately, the majority of people spend their lives in thus rolling.
Do you mean that a man should choose his definite major purpose before beginning his education and prepare himself to specialize in connection with that aim?
Not always. Seldom is a very youthful person who has not finished his basic education in a position to adopt a definite major purpose. In that case, he should complete his essential education through the grades and high school. If he still is unable to choose a major purpose in life, he should either go to work and learn from experience of the possibilities of different occupations, or go to college and take a general liberal arts educational course. After that, one should be able to decide what calling he wishes to follow.
Suppose that a person chooses a definite major purpose, but finds, after he pursues it for a while, that he dislikes it, or he finds something he likes better. Should he make a change?
By all means. A man will succeed best in that which he likes best, all else being equal. It is advisable for one to change, provided he does not get into the habit of changing every time the work he has chosen becomes difficult or he meets with temporary defeat. Changing from one line of work to another involves a tremendous loss. It is something like an industrial plant, the management of which changes from one product to another. The successful person must reach the stage of specialization sooner or later. The sooner, the better.
Is it advisable for a businessman to engage in politics?
Not if he wishes to succeed in business. Politics is a profession unto itself, and not a very dependable one at that. But it is a profession, and those who succeed best at it are those who do nothing else.
What sort of career would you advise a young man to choose, a professional career or a business career?
That depends upon the young man, his likes and dislikes, his native ability, his physical conditions, etc. Generally speaking, I would say that business and industry offer much broader opportunities than do the professions, because the professions are overcrowded already. This is essentially an industrial nation. Industry is the backbone of our economic structure. I have never seen the time when a reliable, loyal, and capable man could not find a place in industry. Here is where most of the larger fortunes are made, which within itself partly answers your question, since most people choose a career with the object of earning a living and accumulating as much wealth as possible. There always has been a shortage of capable men at the head of industry, but never a shortage in the professions.
What about the Army or the Navy or the government service as a career? Are there desirable opportunities in any of these three branches of service?
Again, I must say that this depends very largely on the person who is choosing the career. If a man wishes an opportunity to engage in a creative effort, he would not choose government service as a career, since his chances there would become a matter of the whims of politicians. He would fare better in either the Army or the Navy, since these are somewhat further removed from political influence. Some have made commendable records in both of these fields of the service, but generally they were men who liked that sort of life. The line of promotion in both the Army and the Navy is rather long and by no means easy. Military service calls for concentrated effort and a definite limitation of ambition, as the possibilities of advancement are known in advance. Some men are not suited by nature to limit themselves in this manner. They prefer to take their chances in business or industry, where the risks may be greater and the work harder, but the possibilities of achievement are without any fixed limits.
Would you recommend that an ambitious woman undertake to divide her attention between marriage and a personal career?
No, under no circumstances. Career women seldom make successful wives. Conversely, successful wives seldom make efficient career women. It should be one or the other. I have known of many marriages resulting in failure because of this very situation, where the wife endeavored to divide her attention between her home and a career. It may happen, and it sometimes does, that a married woman is forced to take up a career because of the illness of her husband or his death. But the division of attention between home and career should never be a matter of choice.
Then you recommend concentration of effort through specialization in all callings. You believe, obviously, in a one-track mind.
Specialization through concentration of effort gives one greater power. It saves lost motion in both thought and physical action. It harmonizes with the principle of definiteness of purpose, the starting point of all achievement. I believe in a one-track mind if you allow me to describe it in this way. A wide range of knowledge based on facts related to one's major purpose, but expressed through organized plans for the attainment of that purpose. I might make my meaning better understood if I stated it this way. A man should have a multiple-track mind for the accumulation of knowledge, but a single-track mind for the expression of that knowledge, which is about the same as saying that one should have a reserve of both general and specific knowledge, but he should concentrate its use upon the attainment of a definite major purpose. We have already discussed the fact that knowledge gives one no power until it is organized and expressed in action. That requires concentration of effort. A man may be a walking encyclopedia of general knowledge, and I have known such people. But his knowledge will be practically useless until he organizes it and gives it some form of expression through definiteness of purpose.
I see what you mean. Definiteness of purpose implies concentration of effort. When a man decides to attain any definite end, he must of necessity concentrate his thoughts and his physical action upon that purpose.
That's the idea. You see, therefore, that the person who has mastered and begun to apply the 11 principles of this philosophy previously discussed has begun, at least, to acquire the habit of controlled attention. I call your attention to the fact that the principles of this philosophy are so interrelated that the mastery and application of any one principle leads to the application of combinations of the other principles.
You mean, for example, that when one adopts a definite major purpose as his life work and begins to carry out that purpose, he automatically begins also to make use of controlled attention, self-discipline, organized individual endeavor, organized thought, and self-reliance, as a very minimum. He may, of course, be under the necessity of using many of the other principles, depending upon the nature of his purpose.
That's exactly what I mean. You see, therefore, how impossible it would be for one to single out a definite major purpose and begin carrying out his plans for attaining it without concentrating his attention on that purpose. Carry the analysis a step further and imagine, if you can, anyone mastering and applying the 11 previously mentioned principles of this philosophy without the aid of controlled attention. This principle is an indispensable part of the philosophy of individual achievement. If I had overlooked including it as one of the 17 principles, it would have projected itself into the philosophy wherever one began to apply the philosophy. Thus, you may acquire an understanding of the importance of controlled attention. Without its application, Success in the broader sense is an impossibility.
A rudderless ship and a purposeless man are eventually stranded on a desert sand. Apply the Golden Rule, Chapter 13.
We come now to the 13th principle of individual achievement, the Golden Rule applied, the principle which nearly everyone professes to believe but few people practice, due, I suspect, to the fact that so few people understand the deep underlying psychology of this principle. Too many people interpret the Golden Rule not to do unto others as if they were the others, but to do others and do them plenty before others do them. Of course, this false interpretation of this great rule of human conduct can bring nothing but negative results. The real benefits of the Golden Rule applied do not come from those in whose favor it is applied, but they accrue to the one applying the rule, in the form of a strengthened conscience, peace of mind, and the other attributes of sound character, the factors which attract the more desirable things of life, including enduring friendships and fortune. To get the most from the Golden Rule, it must be combined with the principle of going the extra mile, wherein consists the applied portion of the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule supplies the right mental attitude, while going the extra mile supplies the action feature of this great rule. A combination of the two gives one the power of attraction, which induces friendly cooperation from others, as well as opportunities for personal accumulation.
I assume from your remarks that there are few benefits to be acquired through a mere belief in the Golden Rule.
Very few. Passive belief in this rule will accomplish nothing. It is the application of the rule that brings benefits, and they are so numerous and varied that they touch life through almost every human relationship. These are some of the more important of the benefits. A. The Golden Rule applied opens the mind for the guidance of infinite intelligence through faith. B. Develops self-reliance through a better relationship with one's conscience. C. Builds a sound character sufficient to sustain one in times of emergency. Develops a more attractive personality. D. Attracts the friendly cooperation of others in all human relationships. E. Discourages unfriendly opposition from others. F. Gives one peace of mind and freedom from self-established limitations. G. Gives one immunity against the more damaging forms of fear, since the man with a clear conscience seldom fears anything or anyone. H. Enables one to go to prayer with clean hands and a clear heart. I. Attracts favorable opportunities for self-promotion in one's occupation, business, or profession. J. Eliminates the desire for something for nothing. K. Makes the rendering of useful service a joy that can be had in no other way. L. Provides one with an influential reputation for honesty and fair dealing, which is the basis of all confidence. M. Serves as a discouragement to the slanderer and a reprimand to the thief. N. Makes one a power for good, by example, wherever he comes into contact with others. O. Discourages all the baser instincts of greed and envy and revenge, and gives wings to the higher instincts of love and fellowship. P. Brings one within easy communicating distance of the Creator through the medium of an undisturbed mind. Q. Enables one to recognize the joys of accepting the truth that every man is, and by right should be, his brother's keeper. R. Establishes a deeper personal spirituality. These are no mere opinions of mine. They are self-evident truths, the soundness of which is known to every person who lives by the Golden Rule as a matter of daily habit.
It is apparent from your analysis that the Golden Rule is the very foundation of all the better qualities of man, that the application of this rule provides one with a powerful immunity against all destructive forces.
Your definition is good. It does provide immunity against many of the ills which beset the path of mankind, but immunity is negative. It provides also the positive attracting power by which one may acquire whatever he demands of life, from peace of mind and spiritual understanding on down to the material needs of life.
Some people claim that they would like to live by the golden rule, but find it impossible to do so, due to the fact that those who do not live by this rule would take advantage of them. What has been your experience on this point?
When a man says he cannot live by the golden rule without suffering damage from others, he shows clearly his lack of understanding of this principle, albeit a common misunderstanding. If you will study carefully the benefits I have enumerated, which one may enjoy from application of the golden rule, you will observe that they are benefits of which no one can be deprived. I think this common misunderstanding of the working principle of the golden rule grows out of the belief that the benefits from applying the rule must come from those who receive the benefits, whereas they may come from entirely different sources. Also, the misunderstanding arises from the false belief that the benefits consist only of material gains. The greatest of all benefits attained through application of the golden rule are those which accrue to those who apply it in the form of harmony within their own minds, which leads to the development of sound character. There is no asset comparable in value with sound character, and this is something that an individual must build for himself through his thoughts and deeds. Character is of definite, practical value.
It is not true, Mr. Carnegie, that some people do take advantage of the man who lives by the golden rule, viewing this habit as a weakness to be exploited instead of a virtue to be rewarded?
Some people do this, but the percentage who regard the rule in this manner is so incomparably small that it becomes insignificant by the law of averages. I would estimate that for every person who refuses to respond in kind when dealt with on the golden rule basis, 99 will respond. Thus, by the law of averages, you can see that it pays to overlook the damage that the one may cause. Moreover, the law of compensation enters into the transaction, and by some strange plan of nature with which man is not familiar, even the damage suffered from the short-sighted one is offset by the 99 who do respond in kind. Emerson gave a very clear account of this in his essay on compensation.
But there are so few people who are acquainted with Emerson's essay, or the law of compensation, and many of those who are acquainted with it look upon it as a mere preachment by a moralist, without any real value in the practical affairs of modern life. Will you, therefore, give your views as to the practicability of the law of compensation in the modern affairs of business and industry, such as you have experienced?
My entire experience in business and all other relationships has forced me to accept the soundness of the law of compensation as an eternal verity from which no man can escape, no matter how smart he may be or how hard he may try to avoid it. There is always some compelling circumstances which raises or lowers a man substantially to where he belongs in life, according to his thoughts and deeds. A man may escape the influence of this law for a time, but viewed over a period of an average lifetime, the law forces everyone to gravitate to the exact position where he belongs. His own thoughts and deeds establish the space he may occupy and the influence he may wield in his relationships with others. Man may temporarily dodge his responsibilities to his fellow men, but he cannot permanently dodge the consequences of dodging his responsibilities.
Then it is not sound expediency to adopt the policy of applying the golden rule when its application obviously will bring immediate returns, while failing or refusing to apply it when obviously to do so will mean temporary disadvantage?
No, that would be suicidal, although many people make the mistake of choosing the circumstances under which they apply the rule. To get the fullest benefit of this rule, one must apply it as a matter of habit in all human relationships. There are no exceptions.
That is a pretty conclusive statement. It gives one no leeway in which to temporize with the golden rule. One must either go the whole way or suffer the results of his neglect.
You have the idea. And here let me warn you that everyone is confronted with circumstances which tempt one to neglect the application of the golden rule as a means of temporary expediency. it is fatal to yield to the temptation. Others may not know of the yielding, but one's own conscience knows. If the conscience is overridden, it becomes weak and fails to serve the purpose of guidance for which it was intended. No man should deliberately try to deceive others. And what is more important, he cannot afford under any circumstances to try to deceive his own conscience, since this can serve only the purpose of weakening the source of his guidance. The man who tries to deceive himself is as unwise as the person who would slip poison into his own food.
Obviously, you believe, Mr. Carnegie, that a man can apply the golden rule in all his human relationships and still prosper in this age of materialism?
I would not state it just that way. I would make the statement stronger by saying that the man who lives by the golden rule, mind you, lives by it as a matter of principle, will be bound to prosper within the limits of his own individual capacity, whatever that may be. The results of application of the rule will accrue automatically, and from sources that are often the least expected.
That is a pretty definite statement, Mr. Carnegie. Coming from a man with your broad experience in dealing with all types of people, I have no choice but to accept it as sound. Your own achievements prove that the golden rule can be applied in a material age such as this with profit. I am assuming, of course, that you have always lived by the golden rule, but I should like to have an expression from you as to this.
He is a poor teacher indeed who teaches one thing and practices the opposite. My first understanding of the golden rule was acquired from my mother at an early age, before I came to America. My real knowledge of its soundness came from my experience in applying it to the best of my ability and understanding.
Have you ever suffered temporary loss by applying the golden rule?
Many times. But I am glad you said temporary loss, because I cannot truthfully say that, on the whole, I have ever lost anything from living by the golden rule. Such losses as I have sustained from an occasional circumstance under which the rule was applied without a direct response have been repaid many times from other circumstances where the response was abundant. Let me give you an example of what I mean. When I first entered the steel manufacturing business, the price of steel, as I have mentioned before, was around $130 per ton. That price seemed much too high, so I began to look for ways and means of lowering it. At first, I lowered the price below the then cost of production, although my competitors complained that I was dealing unfairly with them by the practice. Very soon, the increased business that came as a result of the lowered price enabled me to make still further reductions. I soon discovered that lowered prices meant bigger production, and bigger production meant lower unit costs and made lowered prices possible. I kept up this policy until we finally got steel down to around $20 per ton. Meanwhile, the lowered price of steel led to the use of steel in many new forms. And after a while, my competitors discovered that instead of damaging them, I had actually benefited them by forcing them to lower their prices. Thus, the public benefited, the workers in the steel plants benefited, and the manufacturers of steel benefited from a business policy which, at first, had meant a definite loss to the manufacturer of steel. Today, steel is being used for the manufacture of a great variety of articles which could not have been manufactured from it at the old prices. And on the whole, I have never lost anything by forcing the price down. My temporary losses were more than offset by my permanent gains, and I think this fairly well demonstrates how the golden rule works. It may, and oftentimes it does, cause temporary losses. But over a period of time, the gains are greater than the losses.
You mean that the golden rule philosophy harmonizes in every particular with sound business economy.
That's the idea. And if you wish to see how it works out, keep your eye on Henry Ford and watch what happens to his business. He has adopted a policy of giving the public a dependable automobile at the lowest price at which automobiles have been sold. He is putting fine materials and workmanship into his product, and you may depend upon it that the public will reward him with its patronage no matter how many competitors he may have, and he will prosper beyond the expectations of most of those who are now criticizing him. This is a prophecy, but you watch it and see for yourself that it is a sound prophecy. Mr. Ford will be likely to dominate the automobile industry, and he will be sure to do so unless some other far-sighted manufacturer comes into the field and follows his example.
Author's note: this statement by Mr. Carnegie was made in 1909, and every student of this philosophy who is familiar with the astounding Ford achievements will recognize the wisdom with which Mr. Carnegie spoke.
Would it not be impractical for certain types of professional men to live by the golden rule? Lawyers, for example, whose profession makes it necessary for them to prosecute cases which makes the application of the rule difficult.
I could preach you a sermon on this subject, for I have had a great deal of experience with many types of lawyers. But I confine myself to the mention of but one lawyer whose professional policy and its results should be sufficient answer to your question. This lawyer will not accept a case unless he is convinced that he is being retained on the right side. That is, he will not accept a case that is without merit, and I hardly need to tell you that he turns away far more prospective clients than he serves. But I must also tell you that he is busy all the time, and his income, judging from all I know about him, is approximately 10 times that of the average type of lawyer. I pay this lawyer a substantial sum annually, for his counsel alone, quite aside from any other service he renders me. A great many of my friends do the same. We employ him because we have confidence in him, and our confidence is based mainly on our knowledge that he will not mislead a client in order to earn a fee, nor will he accept a case that is unjust or unfair to anyone.
I see your point. A lawyer can live by the golden rule and prosper, provided he is willing to forego the handling of cases that have no merit. But what about the client who comes with the other sort of case, the type that is unjust? It seems that this sort of case is more prevalent than the other type.
In every profession and every business and every occupation, there are ways to make money through unfair practices. And I must confess that there are individuals who are willing to earn money unfairly. But all of them are surrounded by hazards which, sooner or later, dry up the source of income, or bring with it evils, if not losses, out of proportion to the gain. It is true there are many legal cases which have no merit. Some of them are out-and-out attempts to get something for nothing through fraud and deceit. It is a lawyer's privilege to accept this sort of case if he chooses, but I stand on my original statement that such cases bring with them evils out of proportion to the gain to the lawyer. Money obtained unjustly through the tricks of the legal profession may appear to be as good as any other sort of money. But there is a strange influence which accompanies such money, which some people do not wish to be burdened with. Somehow it has a way of becoming quickly dissipated without serving its greatest worth, just as does money that is stolen by highwaymen and thieves. Have you ever heard of a successful highwayman or thief? I have known of many of them getting away with large sums of money. Most of them are now residing in prison. All natural law is moral. The whole universe frowns upon immoral transactions of whatsoever nature they may be. And the man has not yet been born who can successfully run counter to the trend of natural law for more than a brief period. It is my belief that the secret of the great power of the golden rule consists in the fact that it is in harmony with moral laws. It represents the positive side of human relationships. Therefore, it has moral law back of it.
Let us consider the young man or young woman just beginning a career. In what ways may he or she profit by the golden rule?
The first essential for success in any calling of merit is sound character. The golden rule applied develops sound character and a good reputation. You perhaps wish a more concrete example of how young people may profit materially by application of the golden rule, so let us combine the principles of the golden rule and going the extra mile and see what result we get. Let us go one step further and add the principle of definiteness of a major purpose. We now have a combination which, if persistently and sincerely applied, will be sufficient to give any young person more than an average start in life.
Of course, this combination would serve adults as well as youths, would it not?
Yes, if a man knows what he wants, makes up his mind to acquire it, forms the habit of going the extra mile in order to get it, and relates himself to other people on the golden rule basis, he cannot be ignored by the world. He will attract favorable attention, no matter how humble his beginning may be.
Wouldn't these three principles be a pretty good combination for one to apply while going through high school or college in preparation for a life work? Wouldn't they give one a definite advantage over those who fail to apply these principles?
Yes, they would. As I have stated previously, it is one of the weaknesses of most people during their school days that they study for credits and to pass examinations without knowing what they are going to do with their schooling after they acquire it. It is my notion that most purposeless action is wasted, no matter when or where it is performed. The go-getters, as the world calls alert, dynamic, successful people, move with a definite purpose in practically all that they do. They move by a definite motive, a definite plan, and they generally reach their destination because they know where they are going and are determined not to be stopped until they get there.
You believe that those who relate themselves to others on the golden rule basis and make it a habit to go the extra mile will have less opposition from others, do you not?
Generally speaking, they will have practically no opposition from others. On the contrary, they will have the willing and friendly cooperation of others. That has been the history of those who live by these two rules.
Then we may say that these two principles not only serve as a moral guide, but they clear one's path of the usual forms of opposition?
That's the story. Now I must call your attention to another benefit one may enjoy by living by these two principles. It consists of the fact that those who live by these principles as a matter of daily habit will profit by contrast with others who neglect to apply the principles.
Cooperate. Chapter 14.
Inasmuch as you have stated that teamwork is the 14th principle of the philosophy of American achievement, will you name its major benefits, as it may be applied in the practical business world?
To begin with, let us realize that industrial America, as we know it today, could not carry on its vast operation without the principle of teamwork. Every industry you can name is manned by a group of men who coordinate their efforts in a spirit of friendliness, all working together for a common benefit. Small individual businesses may be operated by one man, but any business that takes on the proportion of an industry must embrace and use the principle of teamwork. You see, therefore, that industry and teamwork are synonymous terms, and you recognize, of course, that a successful industry calls for efficient, harmonious cooperation among those who operate it.
Wouldn't that same statement apply as well to the management of a household?
Yes, but we shall come back to that later on. Right now, let us confine our analysis to the larger operations of business and industry. Take the subject of transportation, for example, and you will readily recognize that it calls for teamwork on a huge scale. In railroading, the teamwork principle is so well organized that all major operations are carried out on written orders. Verbal instructions will not do, because the hazards of the railroad business are such that it must be possible to fix responsibilities on all individuals engaged in the operation. The operation of a modern railroad train is one of the finest examples of teamwork. Every train moves on written orders. The orders originate in the office of skilled executives who plan the moves of trains. They are conveyed to trainmen by a dispatcher, who in turn is responsible to the operating executives for their correct delivery and interpretation. The train is in charge of a conductor who moves his train on written orders, except under certain conditions, where he may move a limited distance without such orders. All members of the train crew are directly responsible to the conductor and carry out his instructions without question. Every man working for a railroad, from the humblest track walker to the president of the road, is related to the other workers in a spirit of teamwork that cannot be violated without possible injury to someone.
Would you say, Mr. Carnegie, that the modern railroad executive makes perfect application of the principle of teamwork?
As far as the relationship of the workers of the road is concerned, there is almost perfect coordination of effort, allowing for the unavoidable human weaknesses, and even these are largely safeguarded by mechanical equipment and signal devices which work automatically. But the principle of teamwork should not stop with the mere coordination of effort between the railroad workers themselves, for there is the public served by the railroad which must be considered, because the public pays the salaries of the men who operate the roads. Therefore, the public is the real employer of all railroad men.
But isn't it true, Mr. Carnegie, that the public is forced to patronize railroads whether people like the employees of railroads or not?
That is the general attitude of many people, including some railroad employees. But it is an erroneous viewpoint, and if it is adopted generally by railroad employees, the time will come, and not very far in the future at that, when the railroads will find their business being taken away from them by other forms of transportation, such as automobiles and airplanes.
Automobiles and airplanes are not as efficient as railroads, and they cannot carry the heavier types of freight. How, therefore, can they ever compete successfully with the railroads?
Just remember this. The human element is the controlling factor in all business, including transportation. When enough people cease to wish to patronize the railroads because of the mental attitude of railroad employees, you may be sure that other competitive systems will come into existence to take over the business of the railroads. Airplanes will be refined and made to carry bigger loads. Automobiles will be designed to carry freight and passengers. But more important than these, modern salesmanship will be applied so as to win the public over to these newer methods of transportation.
But, Mr. Carnegie, the railroad executives can use salesmanship also, can they not?
They can, but will they? That's the question. The railroads have had a monopoly on the carrying of freight and passengers for so long that they may be slow to grasp the changing times quickly enough to adjust themselves to the more advanced methods. That is a common error of many people. Failure to recognize facts in time to profit by them. Monopolies often lead to indifference and deterioration in human relationships. The fact that all nature discourages monopolies should be a warning to men to avoid them. Under the American system of free enterprise, we have a form of friendly competition through which we keep the system active, alert, and highly efficient, which amounts to cooperation, considering the system as a whole.
Do you mean that, although the American system of free enterprise is competitive, the various factors of the system are coordinated in a way that gives it power?
Yes, that is what I mean. Take the relationship between the system of free enterprise and the American form of government, for example, and observe that both the government and American industry benefit by between the two. The government protects industry, and industry, in return, helps to support the cost of government through the taxes and wages which it pays to the workers. As long as this system of coordination is carried on in a friendly manner, the American form of government will survive and American industry will prosper, because the combined results of this sort of cooperation represent the American standard of living which is the most prosperous the world has yet known.
Then the government and industry are practically partners in the economic structure of the United States?
Yes, and as such they are subject to all the rules and regulations necessary to make any partnership a success. Both must give in order to receive. Both must work in a spirit of friendliness. Both must recognize the rights and the privileges of the general public, and both must become efficient in serving the public. Here, as in all other human relationships, failure to serve will result in the breaking down of the system. The government must prevent monopolies in industry, but in doing so, it must not become a competitor of industry, and it must not burden industry with unreasonable taxes, nor interfere with industry through unsound arbitrary rules of regulation, which discourage the exercise of personal initiative and the use of accumulated capital. On the contrary, it is the proper function of the government to encourage personal initiative through the fullest exercise of individual cooperation between those who carry on industry and the public they serve.
What would happen if the government became a competitor of industry or burdened industry with regulations and taxes which made it unprofitable for industry to operate?
precisely the same thing that would happen if individuals engaged in industry neglected to cooperate on a friendly basis for a common purpose. This happens sometimes, but it always leads to failure.
You mean that friendly coordination of effort is a requirement for success in all human endeavor?
Personal power is acquired through friendly coordination of effort, and in no other way. In this country, we have an economic system based upon this sort of cooperation. That is why ours is the richest and most powerful nation of the world. We have found a practical way of coordinating the efforts of groups of individuals in all walks of life, and this coordination has given us great power. If you are a close observer, you will have noticed that the individuals who have attained the highest degree of cooperation in their relationships with others are those who have achieved the greatest success in their chosen callings.
You believe, then, that government regulation of industry is for the common good for all. Why?
Because regulation, within the bounds of reason, discourages the greedy and the selfish individuals from seeking monopolies and protects the public against unfair practices in business. Just as there must be unbiased umpires in athletics who see that the rules of the game are observed for the benefit of all the players, there must also be an unbiased governmental umpire who will see that the sound rules of industry are carried out for the benefit of all. Every well-managed business has executives who see to it that all individuals work together in a spirit of teamwork. These executives serve as the umpires who coordinate all factors essential for the successful operation of the business. Their sense of fairness and their wisdom determine the degree of success the business enjoys.
And you believe that a business cannot be successful without the aid of unbiased coordinators known as management?
That is the idea. Small, one-man businesses may operate successfully without a coordinator. But the moment any business requires more than one man for its operation, some individual must assume the responsibility of coordinating the factors which affect the business, or it will not succeed. Business is a science requiring accuracy of judgment, experience, and a sense of fairness. All these factors must be coordinated and applied in accordance with carefully laid plans. Human nature is such that not all men are suited to serve as coordinators. Some men, in fact most men, will not accept the responsibility of efficiently directing themselves, let alone the responsibility of guiding others. Yet, without practical guidance of the workers, no business can succeed.
You mean, then, that the services of a coordinator in business are beneficial to all workers, especially those who will not assume the responsibility of self-direction?
Yes, and I may add that an able coordinator not only serves the interests of a business as a whole, but he aids the individuals who work in the business to so direct their efforts that they can earn more than they would be worth if they lacked this guidance. Men require discipline, guidance, and supervision in order to make their efforts of the greatest value to themselves and to others. If you doubt this, observe what happens when the management of any business becomes inefficient, selfish, or dishonest.
Summed up in a few words, what you're saying is that the coordination of individual efforts is essential for success in any business, and the majority of men lack the ability or the inclination to cooperate with others in an efficient, friendly manner?
That is precisely what I have been saying, and it is supported by the experience of all able business leaders. The best evidence of its soundness may be found in the well-known fact that while ordinary manual labor is always plentiful, managerial ability always is scarce. This is because men with the temperament, education, experience, and personal inclination to coordinate the efforts of others are scarce. This scarcity accounts for the fact that able managerial ability always commands its own price, because here, as elsewhere in the field of economics, the law of supply and demand obtains.
In view of your analysis, may I ask your opinion as to which type of man is the more essential to a well-organized business, the managerial types or the worker who carries out his instructions?
My personal opinion that, as a whole, the managerial type is worth more to the worker than the worker is to the manager, since sound management enables a worker to earn more than he could earn if he worked independently. The ideal setup, of course, exists where the coordinator and the worker recognize the necessity of each other and work together in a spirit of friendliness, as they do in all successful
business.
No, and I work at a risk either the management or the workers damages proportionately the whole business with which they are connected. Friction between management and workers in industry can result only from unwillingness on the part of a few or of many to cooperate in a spirit of helpfulness. Such friction usually is the outcome of meddling by professional agitators who profit by causing friction among workers.
Inasmuch as the American system of free enterprise is inseparably a part of the American way of life, and one of the major foundation stones of Americanism, is it not true that injury or destruction of our system of free enterprise would be the equivalent of an unfriendly thrust at our entire form of government?
That is true. The power that maintains the American way of life, or what we call Americanism, is a coordination of many factors, the major one of importance being our industrial system. And this for the reason that our industrial system is our major source of exchange for commodities and personal services. The greater portion of all money that changes hands in the United States passes through the industrial system in payment for commodities or wages. Therefore, the industrial system pays a major portion of the taxes needed for the operation of the government. Without this source of income, the government would soon become bankrupt, as it produces nothing and earns no direct income.
If the American form of government is ever destroyed or substantially changed so as to limit the personal liberty of the people, from what source do you believe the change will come?
If any such change ever takes place, it will undoubtedly come as the result of interference with our industrial system. Our system of industry is, at one and the same time, our greatest asset and our most vulnerable point. It is the very hub of the American way of life, around which all the lesser factors revolve. It will continue to prosper as long as the government functions in the capacity for which it was created, namely, as a friendly coordinator of all the factors of the American way of life. The government gets its power from the voluntary cooperation of the states, and the states get their power from the voluntary cooperation of the people who live within their borders. And the people get their power from friendly cooperation with one another, as expressed in terms of free enterprise. You see, therefore, that in final analysis, the power of the United States comes from friendly cooperation among the people. If the government is ever radically changed or destroyed, it will be the result of discord among the people, beginning at first, perhaps, in disagreement between small groups and blocks who are motivated by selfish reasons for individual aggrandizement. As long as the people work together in a friendly spirit, there can be no change in our form of government unless the people desire it. And even then, the change will come from within, and it will not be forced upon the people from the outside. You should remember that the power with which the people of America have become prosperous may serve also as a means of self-defense with which they may defend their rights and privileges, including their system of free enterprise.
Budget Your Time and Money, Chapter 15. Andrew Carnegie directed his entire life by a strict budget that covered both his time and his financial resources. His achievements qualified him to speak as an authority on this subject, for America has never produced a man who made better use of his opportunities under the American way of life than did he. Economic and social conditions have changed greatly since Mr. Carnegie's day, but the principles of personal achievement have not changed. They are the same today as they were when he was working his way up from the bottom to an enviable position, and they will serve as effectively today as they did when he was building his career.
Mr. Carnegie, you have named the budgeting of time as one of the essentials for individual achievement. Will you indicate what methods one should adopt to make the best use of his time?
Every successful person plans his life as carefully as a successful businessman plans his business. He begins by adopting a definite major purpose, and he follows through by devoting a definite proportion of his time to attaining the object of that purpose.
What proportion of one's time should be devoted to the attainment of his major purpose?
To begin with, let us recognize that the average person comes into the world with nothing but time as an asset. Each person has 24 hours of time each day, no more, no less. When a person reaches the age of personal responsibility, he should divide his time into three periods. 1. One for sleep. 2. One for work. 3. One for recreation. The usual distribution of this 24 hours per day period is 1. 8 hours for sleep, 2. 8 hours for work, and 3. 8 hours for recreation. Some people, perhaps a majority of them, find it necessary to work 10 hours per day in order to maintain the present standard of living, while they devote but 6 hours per day to recreation. The average person cannot get along on less than 8 hours of sleep.
Which of these three periods of the day do you consider to be the most important?
That depends altogether on what you consider to be important. Sound health demands at least 8 hours of sleep. An average living under our present standard of living demands at least 8 to 10 hours a day for work. This leaves from 6 to 8 hours a day of free time, which one may use as he pleases. And I would say that it is the most important period of the day as far as personal achievement is concerned, because it provides one with an opportunity to acquire additional education, plan new means of rendering service, and create goodwill.
What about the person who uses this period for none of these purposes, but devotes it entirely to personal pleasure, which in no way brings him additional influence or friends?
That person who uses his free time in this manner will never be a success in anything, except by some rare stroke of good fortune which favors him without his own efforts. The sleep period produces no results except that of maintaining sound health. Therefore, one can take no liberties with it, and it holds no seed of opportunity for self-promotion or for the accumulation of material things. The work period requires all of one's thoughts and efforts for specific duties. Therefore, it holds but slight opportunities for extra effort, although one may so use it as to lay the foundation for opportunities by modifying the quality and the quantity of the work he performs. The free time period is just what its name implies, time that one may use as he pleases. Therefore, it is properly called one's opportunity time. During this period, one may not only plant the seed of opportunity, but one may also cause the seed to germinate and grow, by carefully regulating his association with others, and by exercising strict discipline over his own thoughts. The more successful people combine their free time with their work time by devoting all of it to some sort of action which aids them in attaining the object of their major purpose. Thus, they work about 2/3 of their time and sleep the other third.
But isn't it necessary for a man to take time off for recreation and play if he is to maintain sound health?
Yes, sound health demands a change of physical and mental habits. But successful people have learned how to make these changes by so arranging their work time and their free time that the free time provides recreation along lines that contribute to and harmonize with the duties they perform during their work time.
I see what you mean. A man may so use his free time that it brings him opportunities definitely related to his work, such as association with people who can be of benefit to him in connection with the attainment of his major purpose, although his relationship with them may be entirely of a social nature from which he gets his recreation.
That's the idea precisely. But you should recognize the fact that most people do not spend their free time in this manner. They use it for excitement, which too often they mistake for pleasure, and for association with people who influence them by destructive habits, such as drinking and gambling, or people who influence them by just plain laziness. While one's free time may be properly called opportunity time, it usually proves to be one's misfortune time, for it is during this period that most people acquire negative habits which vitally affect their work time. Such habits, for example, as cutting into their sleep time and thereby reducing the efficiency of their work time, as well as impairing their physical health.
I see the logic of your argument, Mr. Carnegie, but is it not true that a well-rounded life calls for play and recreation? That old saying that All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Seems to be sound.
That may be a sound saying, but there are many misconceptions. Speaking for myself and from my observations of the successful people I have known, I can say that there is no better form of play than that which is associated with the planning and attaining of one's major purpose. It would be a mistake to say that I work hard, for the truth is that I look upon my work as the finest sort of play. So does every other man who is succeeding in the true sense of that term. A man's work can be a recreation if he does it in a spirit of intense enthusiasm and likes what he is doing. Enthusiasm recreates, and interest in one's work may therefore be recreation.
I recognize the truth of what you have stated, but what of the forced earnest of work?
I thought you would get around to that question. It is the very question I needed in order to make clear to you the full benefit of that free time period. It is true that a man may not always become enthusiastic.